bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Ah, hello.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Thank you, Andrew Main, who didn't say his name today. Thank you.
Eh. One of these days it was bound to happen. Gentlemen, we got an email, and this is cool. This is a question to us about basically kind of like knowledge systems, note-taking, etc. And the question is, I wonder if any of you guys take notes as a personal knowledge management system regularly and what system they use. There's the popular Zettelkasten system, with popular software tools being the Archive, Zettler, and Rome Research. Even Evernote can be used. Thanks. And so the Zettelkasten system, I don't know much about it. I had a friend, I think you remember him, Jeff Ruttenberg, who was just into every, you know, from the, you know, Franklin Covey planner, every sort of system. He was a guy that was just fascinated into all these sort of different ways of doing that. And this one I remember hearing briefly about, but basically kind of a note-taking system and a way to reference other notes and stuff. And it's just, there are a lot of different schemes for sort of like how you can kind of organize knowledge and, you know, how do you reference one thing to another. And some of these things are, you know, and this is an old system. This is like hundreds of years old, right? And this kind of came back to when people were writing, used to be a very linear sort of thing. Like, I'm going to have an expression of a thought and it's going to be very linear. But then you started to have more complex thoughts and things that say, well, here, I want to reference this idea here. I want to do a tangent here, not because it's a work for somebody else, but for you to organize your own thoughts. And that was what one of these, this system was sort of like, is, you know, you see, you had writing, and then within a few hundred years, you watch the evolution of tools and systems to organize stuff. Dewey Decimal System for books and things like that. So do you guys do notes? Do you do brainstorming? How do you organize them?
I've gone through multiple phases. Maybe the best phase of note-taking I did was when I was preparing for the pitches for what became Scam School and Scam Nation. Like, there are just bricks of 3x5 cards where it's like, I've reading through book after book, it's like, oh, the idea is do this with a napkin, make this prediction, whatever, a quick reference to what page I found it on. I haven't, weirdly, as I moved into the world of comedy with Justin, there's been, at most, there'll be a piece of scratch paper now that just says, Josie's butt, Callie farted, act three, fame. And then that's about as much as I can write down. But it's only because Justin and I on the comedy show have built up a shorthand where we sort of know that we just need a very, very loose framework to go anywhere. And nowadays, whatever note-taking I would have done, oftentimes, as we go back, because it's been 12 years of doing this stuff, it's much, much easier for me to just go back and scroll through, well, what did I do 12 years ago? And then see something and say like, oh yeah, but that was dumb and wrong for this reason. Let's fix it this time. And so it's almost as though I'm living a slow motion Groundhog Day, and as a result, don't feel the need to do as much note-taking as I should. But maybe that's something I should revisit.
I'm a terrible note-taker. I'm a terrible organizer. So I don't. I probably should. And increasingly with larger research projects like Raise the Dead, I find myself having to go back and just by memory remember where I found stuff, where I probably should be a little bit more diligent in, you know, pinning the ideas that I want to follow back up on, you know, just internally, so I know them a little bit better. But no, I've never really done it. I've tried a few times. There was that hot moment in the, you know, the late aughts, early tens, when, like the 43 folder stuff and the Thingiverse, like there was a lot of personal note taking that had GTD. Like a moment. Getting things done. Like, and I just never had the, I never really had the system seemed really cool, but I could never grok it on a level that I needed to come back to it. And so it just kind of fell flat for me.
Yeah. I don't do a lot of note taking, but the most I'll do, and I haven't even done this in a few years, is I would have like a Moleskine sketchbook, online sketchbook, and I would just write everything there. Like indents, like tabs, like are a hierarchy sort of thing, you know, go down and down and down and then in a list and then go out one and then but I haven't really needed stuff. Andrew, you must have some sort of system, right?
Yeah, I'm going to send you a picture, which I'll show you one of the things that I do. I have different things for different sort of projects. And one of the habits I've gotten into is when I sit down to do a thing, I often will start off with writing like a Google Doc. And what I do in there is I'll sort of say, this is a thing I'm doing. This is what it's about. I really believe in mission statements because I think it's very easy to get lost in a project and forget the intent. And for me, it is. And so if I sit down and I'll write a Google Doc and say, hey, this is like, if I'm doing a software project, I kind of start off with like, this is what I'm working on. Like we talked about in the other show, my project AIWriter.app, which had the idea a week ago Saturday, and I sat down on Saturday, you know, evening, and I said, oh, I'm going to do this. I need to have this, this, this. So I did a Google Doc on it. I often never go back to it, but just putting my thoughts into another medium helps it be very clear to me. And then I will, it depends upon how I have to break a thing down. Like I have a notebook next to me for this is, you know, I have to go look through here to see like when I break, like if I need to do a software thing, I'll say like, I've been building like a voice interface for the OpenAI API, a way to talk to it, have it talk to you. And I just built a little simple flow chart, you know, just so I know, you know, okay, this is where the data is going. If I write a book, you know, I have a system for a book, and that's a photo Bryce just showed. If you want to show that again, this is my latest book. And basically what I did is I needed to write from different points of view from two different characters. This is my new Jessica and Theo book. And so I knew when the characters switched back and forth. And so I had it organized, you know, both it's organized laterally and horizontally. This probably looks like somebody who's a highly organized person or psychotic. I used to not be this organized. I used to be not organized at all. I used to be just seat of the pants, do whatever I do and plan. But I found the more I planned things and was organized, the more successful the outcome.
I mean, I have found myself with a current project doing more. You know, I think part of it is in anything, and this is probably where my disconnect came in, is that I need to understand the form of something before I can understand filling it in and organizing it. Like I need to kind of see the 360, and like the workflow that I've had with larger projects now is, you know, to just get like with like Raise the Dead, what I found is that the best way to go for me is to write an absolute garbage draft, like just get to the end of it and know that it is bad, but then record it and then listen to that recording just so I can I can now grok it as an unformed ball of clay. And then I'll think about it like, oh, no, here's the story. The story is like where I found myself being connected and then I went away from it because it was a garbage draft. That's what I need to focus on. And here's where I need to build up if I want to get to this place at the end. And so at that point, I could now understand, and I'd done that enough times that I now got like, oh, okay, well, here's what a Raise the Dead episode is. It's got this thing at the front, it's got this element, it's got this one big story, and then we have our kind of wrap up and where are they now is at the end. And it's like only when I realized that, which was like after the first season, did I realize, oh, I can break this up into 9 segments and I can write for those 9 segments. And so now my garbage drafts will be just a little less garbage because I will at least know this is the form of it. But I literally just had to do a bunch of random trash before I even figured out that like these were holes that I needed to fill, like that I could even chop things up in that way. And so now I'm a lot more organized, but before, oh man, like I think where I spun my wheels a lot more is that I would just work so much on the drafts. I would write a draft and then review it as a written word, and I would perfect it as a written thing, and then I'd read it and be like, oh, this sucks. Like, yeah. This might read well, but it's not going to speak well.
I've only written a few books, but the best advice I ever got, and we've talked about this before, is turn off the monitor. Like, disconnect your ability to edit as you write. You have to write first, and then you edit. Recently, I was trying to think of how on this, you know, how to build an independent brand, whatever, book, I wrote, the tone was entirely too hostile. There's too many curse words, but I sent it's way too cocky. But I sent a copy over to, Andrew, and I was like, look, all these things need to be fixed, but, I literally would never have written this if you had called me out for the voice. And the idea of an almost self-loathing how-to guide, I don't think I've seen in success world.
And I owe you a call because I want to talk to you about that at some point. I want to wrap my head around it.
Maybe the answer where we're going to get eventually on the call is that I write it in the self-loathing voice, and then just somebody who is not me removes all the self-loathing parts.
I have some thoughts
about this,
and we'll talk. I'll say that what both of those processes, like, yeah, sometimes like you can have like, people can say this is the perfect system until we know what our work is. It's really hard. And somebody can come in, I can come in and say, oh, you need to do it this way. And like, I need to understand things from the inside out. So I need to know what I want to do. And I would say, Justin, you talked a lot about what I see a lot of writers go through is they set out to make the work and then they go back and try to fix the work, and I would say the next step is to say, what is the minimal version of it you can create where you will spot the flaws? And that's what I do with my outlines. Yeah. I write these outlines that are like pretty, I can spot the plot flaws in an outline. I go look through this and I go, oh, I need to fix this. And I noticed that this is a thing I noticed with myself and other people. Sometimes I would start to write an outline that I'd stop halfway through, like, no, I just want to write this. But I'd often stop when I didn't know where the outline was going to go, and I assumed that writing the story would tell me. And I think that's kind of a mistake, at least in my case, because I think that what that means is I don't know where it's going to go. And the answer will not magically manifest in the middle of the story. It means I need to go a couple steps back in my outline and think it through. And, you know, I probably talk a little bit too much about, you know, my writing speed more than I probably should in some places, because I think that leads to people making assumptions. And, you know, the thing that I don't emphasize enough is how much my process affects that before then, how much of the system I use to write outlines to do that means that my first drafts don't get edited down. They get added to, you know, and I think that's a thing where everybody should think about. Not everybody. Some people might want to think about is, what's the minimal version that I can go in and fix? So when I go do the bigger version, I'm not having to go change 40% of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that's, I would say in my process, most of where I need to improve is what Andrew said, just get to the minimum viable, like, all right, what's the thing I need to just like listen to get it to the audio level where it's like, okay, this is closer to what it could be. The better I'm going to get at this, the more organized I get at this, the more I understand the form, the better my garbage drafts are going to be. And the more I can spend on making a more informed first attempt into a better, final product, you know, but it's a process.
Yeah. So another thing I do is I've talked about this before. I use Apple Notes, use the Notepad app a lot, use hashtags. It's a great way just to keep track of stuff. It just, you know, a lot of those earlier systems like Zettelkasten and stuff like this were invented prior towards using electronic systems to help you sort and organize things. And, you know, they mentioned Evernote, which Evernote was always a bit unwieldy for me. I played with a lot in the beginning, but it just became too much of, you know, I tried to do everything, which I think for some people it's wonderful. Google Docs, I think, could be improved a lot, but I still just do a lot of it. Like, just make a Google Doc, throw it in there. You know, it's in that other hemisphere, and then I can find it later on. You know, smaller stuff, just notes. And I think that makes it easy, so.
Yeah, I know it's bad form and unpopular, but I still write myself emails like before.
That's great. Why is that?
Well, because people say you shouldn't use your email as a to-do list. And if you're me, somebody who habitually treats a email flow like a river where you can either grab it or not or whatever, at the very least, I could say, you know, which one of these did I send to myself? And then kind of glance over and say, oh, you know what? That seemed like a good idea at the time, but I don't think so or whatever.
Yeah, I think that sounds great. I think that often, you know, we make decisions about, you know, email in 2010 or even email in 2000 is different than email in 2020 with labels and sorting and all this sort of stuff. I use Google Docs because I'm pretty sure of the permanence of that. You know, I use notes because I'm pretty sure of the permanence of that. And email is another thing that I'm pretty sure about the permanence of that. And I mean, yes, ... exceptions, but compared to other apps and other systems, I think that's a perfectly fine system.
You need the system that, like, to me, a system is as good as the products you make because you have the system. Yeah. I think that there are some people that it gives them peace of mind in their daily life to have a system. I am not one of those people, but I assume if you are, then that's good. For me, the system is only good if by the end of it, I can say, oh, yeah, look, I got this done. I didn't get distracted. Right. I didn't change streams. Yeah.
Yeah, you can measure, what did you do? Did you do it? Check yes, no. And then that's all you need. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say another advantage to your email, Brian, is that the medium affects things a lot. You know, if we write something down in a notebook, it sometimes feels more real in some ways, but it's not as easily accessible. And if you write yourself an email, it feels a lot like you're programming yourself.
Yeah.
Which,
well, and plus also like you're stepping outside of yourself. You're treating that future you as somebody with their own agency, and you can say things that you would never say in an app. Stuff like, hey, man, I know you're really going to want to play The Last of Us Part 2 with your daughter tomorrow. If you could do me a favor, just carve out 30 minutes, knock out this, just deposit these checks. This guy's been waiting on a payment for a while. It should only be 25 minutes. Love you from the past. Good night. And then, you know, I it sounds so silly when I put it that way, but I have no doubt that everybody believes I do exactly that.
I think it's great. I also imagine you getting this letter from me like, how does he know this stuff?
I mean, it's like I get halfway through the letter and I'm like, oh, I bet he's going to. Yep, me. He sure does know me.
I think it's a great system. I think that's great. And there also, it's like, I remember like Merlin Mann described like a nerd as somebody uses the telephone to talk about the telephone.
Yes. And great description.
A lot of organizational systems, like I'll say this about my friend before, like a lot of like people seem to be like, how to organize my books on organizing, you know, how to organize all these organizational systems and stuff. And I think that if it works, it works. People get excited about I love this thing because it's going to fix my life. It's like, tell me 5 years from now, tell me, did it make a change? Or 3 months later, did you move on to another thing? Mm-hmm. So if emails work, I think I want other people out there to try Brian's email system.
I would say that the email system itself hasn't been great so much as building a system of interconnected social structures where it's harder than ever to forget to do anything, because it's like, like I'm at place A, I'm talking to person 12, which means, oh, there's no running away and playing Hearthstone right now, because that means person 13 is about to show up. And, you know, that's part of what I loved about the ecstasy of being on the road, was that you didn't have a lot of choice. And so I'm trying to build that here, so that I'm constantly, from the moment I show up to the moment I leave, available for various people to grab me to do things that need to be done.
Yeah. Good point. So
person 12's annual celebration is coming up. Please initiate celebratory voice change.
Happy 30th, Bryce.
Thank you.
keep going. We could do this Terminator bit all day.
We're walking down a weird path. I don't know if I feel comfortable.
Better than Robocop.
I want to segue over here too. It's like, when it comes to the concept
of prioritization. I bought you clothes and shoes and a motorcycle. Sorry.
As I said, I wanted to segue into the idea of, when it comes to prioritization, is, you know, we were overwhelmed by news. And my favorite new horrible term is doom scrolling. You know, the idea of keep scrolling through new horror. It's one of these things. I read that, I'm like, yeah, you know, that's a
feel
thing.
That.
You know, and I think that one of the ways you can find balance is you can make a decision for yourself to say, okay, do I want to be media, and I mean social media and media driven, or do I want to be data driven? And the difference between this is when you decide what your priorities are, both emotionally and practically speaking, is to say, okay, am I going to be motivated by what I'm being told I need to be motivated by, or what I need to be concerned about or worried about? Or am I going to be motivated by what I know, you know, with the data? You know, what's the data? I got to pay my bills. I got to do my taxes. I got to do these things. I need to spend time with my family. And then my opinions of what's going on in the world, are they going to be shaped by headlines and tweets, or are they going to be shaped by data? Am I going to go look at the data and say, okay, what if I'm going to worry about problems, what problems do I want to worry about? And I use this a lot, and I do this, and it sort of affects sort of like part of my charitable giving, is I look at things, not who's making me. I look at, like, I sit back and I go, and my charitable giving is very tiny. Let me put that very clear, compared to like really magnanimous people. But when I do say, oh, you know, it's tax season, whatever, I need to make, you know, up level up my donations or do more stuff, I go, okay, what do I think are problems? What are things I want to address? And then that affects that, not what's right in front of my face. You know, because these become, they have their own momentum to stuff. And that's the thing I think that's worth looking into, is to say, okay, do I want to be data driven, and meet data both from how I prioritize and what I pay attention to?
So here's my only thought on the idea of separating media from data, is that we are all inherently going to look at things different in terms of how we find our data, and whether or not we like our tolerance level for the amount of synthesis that those numbers will go through. So it's like, for example, if we're going to look at politics, all right, media for sure is like Maggie Haberman's articles from the New York Times. Like, you know, think that she's a great reporter or a bad reporter. Like, that is classic narrative from trusted source media. Like, that is as old school as that gets. So, okay, if I'm not going to do that, and instead I want to educate myself on some of the underlying issues that she's reporting on, where do I go for that data? And do I go to sites that have now become new pillars of media that have made their bones on not being the, oh, trust us because we're the New York Times, but rather we take data and synthesize it for you. And that now fills in the idea that, oh no, I am a data-driven person. Like I read 538 or I read these, you know, this amazing tweet thread that broke down the real numbers. Because I think that there's a fuzzy line there where I would say, if you were to ask that on Twitter to some of the most problematic people that have created the doom scrolling culture that we're in right now, I think the vast majority of them would say, yup, I agree with you. That's why I'm data driven.
Yeah. And I guess that, and I should qualify this. It starts even from saying that, like, if you say, okay, you know, like for me, I go like, you know, what are my values? You know, my values is, you know, improving quality of life for other people. Right. And then I'm like, okay, what that, and then my source isn't going to be to go look to a media source. My source is going to look like, well, let me look at some research papers and stuff like this to see, like, you know, what are the biggest problems facing people, both, let's say, domestically, internationally. And domestically, you know, income disparity, it's a huge problem. You know, a lot of the problems that we see in the media, I think, are more well explained by, you know, class issues in income disparity. And I'm like, okay, how do you solve income disparity? I'm like, well, there's family structure, things like this, but education's a thing. And it's like, you know, the software industry, you know, it's underrepresented by certain groups of people. Like there's not enough people, certain people in there. And I'm like, okay. And I'm a person thinks that the more voices that come into it, the better it is. How do I address that? And so it's like, you know, part of my charitable giving goes towards organizations that do things like launchcode.org, which, you know, provides free software instruction and coding instruction to people in inner cities, people who traditionally wouldn't have access to it. Cause like, to me, that's great. Like that's my thing. Like I don't do politics. I don't do any of that. I think to me, that's inefficient, where I'm like, oh, you know, if I can go commit, you know, donate to a program and I know this is going to help X number of people get closer to, you know, computing degrees, then I'm living to my value, you know, and that's sort of me. It's more like not even going to media sources that tell me about data, like going strictly to data sets and say, what are these problems? And then going, how do you directly address those? And, you know, the person who did that in a big way was Gates. And, you know, in the 90s, he got criticized because he didn't donate to charity. There were these screeds about how stingy he was and how greedy he was. But you read these bios about him. They talked about he would spend his summer vacation or his vacations reading books on viral diseases and, you know, the problems of, you know, lesser developed countries and water and stuff. And finally, when Bill Gates stepped back from Microsoft and said, okay, I'm going to get into the charitable giving thing, the most amazing, you know, benefactors humanity's ever known, he has saved millions of lives, you know, with helping, you know, make HIV, you know, treatments available, et cetera, and other initiatives. Like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has done incredible stuff because he says, I'm not going to just give it to some other foundation and say, oh, I did a good job, or go back a bunch of political candidates because they tell me they're going to do a good job. He's like, no, I'm going to build an institution that's going to try to really address that. And that's the kind of thing I mean by data-driven, is the idea of like really get to the problem and say, how do I approach it?
Yeah, this is something I wrestle with because I personally have a long way to go to hit the long-term promises of everyone I've made individually to the team. And, you know, I mean, as far as the tax man knows or cares, like whether I give the money to charity or give it to,
I'm going to do a timeout. Yeah. I don't mean, charitable giving doesn't have to do anything with it. Brian Brushwood talking about critical thinking, Brian Brushwood spending his time talking about science education. That is a value. That is a tremendous value.
Sure, sure.
So, and I would say even more valuable than somebody saying, oh, I'm going to write a check or do this. So,
sure. But I suppose emotionally, I feel a heavy obligation to, yes, of course, my nuclear family. But then beyond that is, you know, our business family, the producers, editors, everybody who by every second that somebody is here, they're choosing to not be somewhere else, somewhere more established, someone farther ahead, blah, 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 which it really, you know, it's just as tax deductible either way. And that's the moral obligation I feel, is to, these are people who are showing up because they believe that we've got something here. And so I dial in very, very heavy on that. And I get a bit uncomfortable when it comes to questions of, you know, where should I toss some coin for charitable giving? Because it's like, I've got a long way to go just to fill the buckets of the folks who are physically here that I see every day, you know?
Brian, let me make it very clear. I think that I think that charitable giving in many cases is overrated. I think people building businesses is great. I think the fact that creating jobs for other people is the best thing. I think that's ultimately the goal. I think that's the goal. It's not even need. So I think that what you do and other people do in creating business and opportunities for other people.
Dude, I hear you 100%. And I think Bryce will agree. Bryce, you're comfortable with a reduction in wages, right? So that we can donate to a cause of... No, sorry. It's never funny to joke about that stuff when in that kind of situation.
Yeah, and I think let me make that very clear, because I think most, a lot of having worked in charities and seen this stuff, I think a lot of it's BS. I think that a lot of it's very wasteful, very, very wasteful. And often people write checks to things and feeling they did good. And I'm like, you may have made the problem worse. You know, you may have misdirected money to something that maybe wants to continue this or is doing bad solutions and stuff. And I think that, like, you know, Warren Buffett's 99% giving pledge. My problem with that is, like, basically that is that he's talked to other billionaires about promise to give away 99% of your money to charity. I'm like, giving it to charity doesn't mean it's necessarily going to really solve the problems. Like, I would say, you know, commit your wealth towards building a better world, which could be done from, you know, creating an ethical pharmaceutical company. You know, it could be created, you know, be done by creating a company that's going to build water filtration systems for the third world or toilets or whatever. Like, and it will be more sustainable, because you could donate to a charity. Charities then have to go out. Charities are very good at getting funding. And I've seen how much of the effort goes towards fundraising versus what they're trying to do. So I guess where I'm seeing the priorities of, like, I think your priority is, I have a business, take care of my family and take care of my employees. That's great. You've made a decision to say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to fire everybody. So, you know, I can go walk, you know, across America and understand America and then decide what I'm going to do next. You know, like, I think it's the best value somebody can do is create a job for somebody else. So my hat's off to you, sir.
I suppose what I want to explore is, if the subject is charitable giving, whether it's tax deductible or not, I have found that emotionally I get very confused, because it's hard to know. You know, your family, you take care of your family, but then what happens when your family expands by 6 to 8 more people, you know, sometimes full-time, sometimes part-time, and then your family expands a little bit more with, you know, a bunch of co-hosts on a bunch of podcasts or whatever. And it's like, it's so hard to see beyond them. The moment there's any kind of ducats in your fingers, to want to throw anything past anyone I hadn't thought much about this until we brought it up just now.
Yeah, and I feel bad I even brought up the idea of charitable, because it wasn't about that. The idea was about prioritization. Yeah. When you see issues in the, it was really about, like, what do I do when I see an issue in the world that I want? I mean, years ago, it was critical thinking. Like, and I was worried about, you know, science education, critical thinking. I volunteered, you know, I did programs in schools, and then I became, you know, worked for a foundation where I went out there and I said, I'm going to spend my time working on critical thinking education. And it wasn't, you know, I worked for an organization, did that, but that was not me giving away, but it was me directing my energy. And I was just trying to use this as an analogy of directing energy or resource towards, you know, and your attention. Like, where do you pay attention to? And for me, it's like, well, I looked at the data to see what concerns me. And I look at what the data, what it concerns me now. And it's not whatever the media tells me the current narrative it is, because
I think to answer your question, I just happen to be in a place where I, in the battle between data and media, really neither is a player, given that I see the faces of the human beings that I'm here to fill.
But I started this by saying it starts from you, yeah, and then your people, your, yeah, family, and the people around you. That's where it starts.
I'm still on that phase, I guess, would be my answer.
Bryce, you've been trying to get something.
So
here.
I have a question about the initial question, right? The idea of, are you more data driven or media driven? I guess just from an exploratory standpoint, what are the pros or the benefits of being media driven? Because it feels a little one-sided, and I'm not quite sure if we're saying, like, here are two valid things, or here is an advocation for, you know, doing, and because either's fine, but I want to know if what we're saying here.
I can speak for the media. Yeah. If no one else will, I'll speak for the media. I think it is an idea of connecting to what your neighbor thinks. I think that there is a danger to being too data driven in that your own, you know, your own philosophies, your own instincts can often be reinforced. You know, data is as good as it is interpolated, right? And you can have like a more rigorous way of looking at it, and you can try to challenge your own beliefs, and you can try to reinforce the fact that just because you find a thing doesn't mean that it is totally justified in your mind. But often we don't. And the more we are apart from other people, the more we find our own beliefs, in my opinion, hardening. So what the media can do at its best is let you know other perspectives, let you know other points of view that are articulated and put out there in a human context for which we will always be able to latch onto. Now, the OD'd point, which is, I think, if we're going to get into like elements of doom scrolling and stuff like that, is that you are now crossing into the world where it's more of a mob. Now you're not just being a thoughtful neighbor and challenging your own beliefs because of what somebody else is saying. Now you're at the point where we're in a panicky moment and you're looking for a reason to reinforce the fact that if everybody's panicking, then I need to. I inherently need to find the thing that will put me into a position of panic, or I want to file in along with everybody, because that is, now's the time. The time to shout is now. The time to panic is now. Mm. So clearly based on these media narratives that are set out.
Yeah, I guess I would say that the idea is be media aware. And then sort of to me, it's like, now let me look at the data to figure out like what, because every voice that I hear out there, and even ones maybe I largely agree with, has an agenda. And also it's like, and if you agree with this, then you have to agree with this other thing too. But, and I'm like, I don't know that, you know, and that's why I kind of like the idea of like, one, figure out your own values. And I think that, you know, it starts with, you need to take, you know, personal responsibility, family responsibility, responsible to your friends, your employees, and the people around you. And then there's, you know, and then your place in your community and what you want to do there. And for me, a lot of it's like, let me look at the data. You know, like I look in, you know, in LA, you know, a thing that I've not done anything about, I've done nothing about other than just talk about it, which, you know, shows you how useless I am as a person, but it's a big mental health problem. And it's, you know, we have a drug problem and a mental health problem. It's one of the reasons why we have a really big homeless problem. And, you know, and I don't know what those solutions are. It's a thing that I follow and I look at the data to see what's being said about that. And I share frustrations, but I also like, well, we have people who need help. I don't know how to give it to them right now. I'm aware of organizations and stuff. I'm not sure if they're good at what they're doing, but, you know, I use, you know, the media says, oh, look at this thing. I'm like, yeah, let's figure out what's going on here. And then maybe I'll form an opinion later on. I don't have to have an opinion on everything.
Sure. Cool.
Fun talk, guys.
You got any picks?
Yeah.
I got a pick. I do. Warrior Nun. Watch the first two episodes of it. If you enjoyed Buffy the Vampire Slayer and wished it would come back, guess what? It's back. It's called Warrior Nun.
Yeah, we were watching this for spoiler in time. And the other show that we're watching right now is what's that HBO one?
Oh, the heavy, I Know This Much Is True.
I Know This Much Is True, which is just constant tragedy.
I still have to finish the second half of that one.
Warrior Nun is just like, let's just like fight some demons and like
we just have a dead girl, just one dead girl come back to life,
please,
have her dance and date and kill demons and have a fun time and make funny jokes with criminal friends, come on, just once.
It felt a little in the trailer, it felt a little like Stranger Things meets Preacher.
Imagine a lot of what you liked about Preacher in that it was transgressive to have everything be set in playing with religion. Remove heavy duty, surprising, shocking gore and instead put female empowerment and you have Warrior Nun. It's great. I like it a lot.
Yeah. I'll back that play. That's I'm glad we decided to do that.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of shows coming out right now, but I think this will be a fun couple of weeks to do.
Here's my pick. Season 2 of The Expanse. We're expanding.
So how did you feel about or I guess Fedora Hat's still around. Oh, sorry. How do you feel about Fedora Hat?
Wow.
At this point.
Wow.
This isn't a spoiler. is the mantra. I like him a lot more. He's still alive. Which I didn't know he wasn't alive, but I do now.
I mean, eventually everybody dies.
Sure. it really actually makes a lot of context to where we are in the story now. I like him a lot better as a wayward mercenary than I liked him as a noir detective.
Brian gives me so much crap for doing that on the outsider.
He did. On the outsider. Oh, God damn it. I was, all right, guilty.
I think Brian could have a job working for like the CIA. Like, Brian, don't let him know we got 40 nuclear warheads in Germany. Okay.
Yeah.
You know? You're like, now go have dinner with the Russian ambassador. Like, oh, yeah.
I'm not going to say how many dozens of nuclear warheads we have in Germany.
It was more than a couple.
But let's just say, if your wife ever said, go out and get some number of eggs, she wouldn't ask you for 100, would she? Nope. Probably ask you for, but more than a dozen, right?
More than a dozen. What is she making?
Do I have a pick? I don't think I have a pick. Warrior Nun is very good. Andrew,
my pick is the book Wisdom of the Crowds by I think it was James Surowiecki, which was a really good book that shows, and I think maybe most of us read it here. The idea is it's not the wisdom of the mob. It's not put a bunch of people into the room and let them argue and get their point of view. It's the opposite. And I brought this up. It's one of these books that, like, sometimes people would quote it and not get it because they would get the wrong sort of conclusion. It's the idea that ask 40 people independently and the crazy voices will tend to cancel each other out. And the center will sort of center around kind of what the expert view on something is. And he provides a lot of wonderful examples. And I want to follow up, see what else he's written kind of on that topic. But it's a really good idea. If you want to understand at its best how markets of ideas work and kind of like all kinds of markets and democracies and stuff like that can work at their best, it's the idea of like have a lot of voices and then let each have sort of their individual opportunity to say something. And then you sort of even it out and then you start to get signal from the noise. So. Big fan.
Nice.
Right. Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.